He wore a cheap watch and carried his belongings in plastic supermarket bags and travelled economy class. And he does seem to have presented quite an eccentric appearance.
Your question of what was in his motivations, I mean, I do think that's the million-dollar question, quite frankly. If you can answer that, let me know.
I do think one of the significant underlying motivations was to right wrongs.
My name is Roma Downey, and I'm on the trail of the mastermind maverick who built up a global duty-free empire, but in the end was left with nothing. An Irish-American who yearned to reconnect with Ireland, whatever it took, and a businessman who was hiding a secret that when it came out, would have everybody talking. This is Chuck's Secret Bucks, Episode 3.
When I first met Chuck, he was rarely in one location for more than 3 or 4 days. And by that I mean he was literally flying around the world all the time.
Of course, Chuck was no stranger to travel with the line of work he was in. But now he was up to something entirely different, something that required the utmost secrecy, and something that was financed by all the profits from his duty-free enterprise, unknown to his then business partner, Bob Miller, or his nephew, Tommy.
Duty-free was kicking into gear, and riches were now pouring into the coffers.
And those coffers allowed Chuck and his family to enjoy the high life. His eldest daughter, Juliet.
Our experience was that we were always going back to either France, Hawaii, Hong Kong. We always lived in some nice places, nice houses. There was always, because 5 kids and a lot of guests and a lot of people coming in and out, we always had some staff.
Chuck, who loved the thrill of the chase in business, was living the American dream. He had millions in his bank account and 7 international homes across the world. But during the 1970s and early 80s, something changed, like a switch had been flicked.
It was a mental recognition that he didn't need material things anymore.
That it's not, you know, how big your yachts are or how big your bank accounts are or how many castles you own or the branded clothes you wear. Those are not particularly significant.
His daughter Leslie believes that one profound experience her father had began a domino effect, leading to a decision that baffled many.
I've got to believe, but I mean to be confirmed, that him going back to Ireland in the 70s with his children, and I think seeing that Ireland was still really struggling, how Ireland still needed so much help, I think it would have really frustrated him. So I think it connects him back to, you know, his childhood, sitting at the kitchen table with his mother, who had a very, very big impact.
Madeline, she was sort of the neighborhood type of guardian angel. She used to help out a lot of families that were struggling at that time. She would somehow enable some assistance to go in their direction without feeling like the people would receive some sort of handout.
And I think because of his mother, his parents, it goes deep. I think it really does. I really believe it goes very deep.
I was becoming more familiar with Chuck's expanded global business activity.
Chris Exley, an American lawyer, recruited to work for Chuck.
But I was not aware that Chuck had already made the decision, in fact had acted, on assigning, transferring his entire business interests to a charitable foundation.
It was one of the biggest single transfers in history, and it was all done in secret. In 1984, in the tax haven of the Bahamas, on the day after Thanksgiving, Chuck, in a stroke of a pen, did what just about anyone in a multinational boardroom would consider corporate suicide. But what he did was so unusual that nobody found out. By all appearances, it looked as though Chuck was still the co-owner of Duty Free Shoppers, raking in all the profits, but in reality, Chuck was broke.
Before Atlantic, he was, you know, he was a different person. After, another different person.
Chuck recognized that there were people who had talents that could change people's lives. And if there was any way that he could help those people, he was going to do that.
So Chuck started to make it his focus to find the people, the places, and the organizations that he could try to help. Camouflaging his wealth with his off-the-peg clothes, he could get on with the job unnoticed and unhindered. And Chris Exley would become a very serious figure in Chuck's latest racket.
Wherever we went, people didn't know who he was. And it was just great to be moving around, really, the world, and not having anybody know that he was an extremely wealthy person, because that was just Chuck's style.
His nephew Tommy says it wasn't long before he found causes to support.
Like Dr. McGee, who started a non-profit organization called Operation Smile, and they would go into places like Thailand and Cambodia and places along that lines, and they would perform surgery on young children that had cleft palates, and they would completely rehabilitate this young person's whole existence. They would just lift their whole self-esteem.
Chris Exley.
Chuck and Atlantic were really about betting on people. There were individuals that Chuck met that inspired him, and he saw in them their abilities to leverage and amplify impact in health and education in particular. And he saw facilities as being the platform from which their work could be done.
Chuck started to finance bricks and mortar projects around the world, like in Vietnam, building schools, medical clinics, and rural infrastructure such as bridges and wells. In South Africa, where the legacy of apartheid loomed, Chuck ignited increased access to antiretroviral drugs. In Ireland, he started to pour money into third-level education.
There was a point in Chuck's life where he turned his attention from making money to focusing his efforts on giving it away.
But it wasn't only Chuck's sense of purpose that was undergoing a transformation. It was also his personal life. He and his wife Danielle started to grow apart and then parted ways. In their settlement, Danielle got the family homes and each of his children got an endowment. But Chuck didn't want ownership of anything. And he eventually went on to marry his long-term German assistant, Helga.
By that point, my parents had separated and my father had remarried, and, you know, they lived out of hotels and suitcases. And he, like in the space of 2 months, would have, you know, been in 10 different places. And then he would have like gone back to each place 3 times. It's really incredible.
I have to say that there are similarities in the places where Chuck developed an interest in investing philanthropically. He looked at places where people had historically been undervalued, underappreciated, or where there was conflict, places like Vietnam, South Africa, Ireland, Northern Ireland. I do think one of the significant underlying motivations was to right wrongs.
Here's Bill Gates. Yes, that Bill Gates, who started Microsoft and invented Windows.
I was aware that there was a big anonymous donor, but I didn't really understand the story until 1997. He happened to do it through an offshore entity where he'd, you know, taken a large sum of money, you know, and picked education, healthcare. You know, he picked countries that whose political system was changing, you know, which was bold of him. He did some giving in Cuba.
Chris Exley found himself at Chuck's side in Havana, facing an enemy of the state.
We were invited one evening with little notice, which is sort of the typical process in Cuba, and we were invited to meet with Fidel and spent a lot of time. He was quite a talker, very intelligent, very well informed, and through an interpreter, spent nearly 7 hours in conversation with him, in which he talked about Cuba's economy and its struggles and a lot of global issues. Well informed, very stimulating discussion. And at the end, Chuck said, "I'm sorry, but my wife doesn't know where I am, and I think I need to move on, to which Fidel said he was very sorry to have kept Chuck from Helga, and said, I will have to meet with you tomorrow and apologize to Helga. So we met again at the airport just before we left, and Fidel gave Helga flowers and apologized for keeping Chuck away for so long. So yeah, we had a couple of sessions.
Chuck's money started to filter into Cuba and other places around the world.
I do recall the story when we met again with Fidel. He brought a box of very nice cigars for Chuck and said to Chuck, do you smoke? And Chuck said, no, I don't smoke. And Fidel said, do your friends smoke? And Chuck said, no, my friends don't smoke. And Fidel said, well, better yet, give these to your enemies.
But Chuck was still operating under the cover of being a co-owner of Duty Free Shoppers and hiding his secret that he had signed over his fortune to Atlantic Philanthropies. Atlantic had also become much bigger than Chuck, employing a clandestine network of undercover operatives working worldwide. Atlantic Senior Vice President of Programs was Martin O'Brien.
And at the height of it, I guess there were, across the world, there were about 130 people working to give away this man's money. It's like $1 million a day.
People were asked not to reveal where the money had come from.
In Northern Ireland, Ken Logue was one of those undercover operatives working for the Irish branch of Atlantic called Tara Consultants.
We were trying to be incognito, and we approached organisations that we thought were working in the right direction, working according to how we felt things might develop. So people didn't approach us, we approached them. But we didn't follow government guidelines.
Atlantic was willing to take calculated risks on people and organisations that they believed could make a positive difference in Northern Ireland, such as Northern Ireland Alternatives, which worked with former combatants to help end kneecappings and punishment attacks, with the offenders acknowledging responsibility and compensating their victims with the agreement and cooperation of paramilitaries. But this was one step too far for the then British government. Co-director Debbie Waters.
So can you imagine that an embargo came from Westminster through the Northern Ireland office to a small community group on the Shankill that had three staff?
The government at the time, the Northern Ireland office, described their work as novel and contentious. Funding ceased, and that's when Atlantic stepped in.
So what we did was, with Atlantic on our side, we took on government. A small community-based organisation took on the government, and in essence, we won. So if you want a model of activism, if you want a model of peace building that works and truly works, it's us, and it is all because Atlantic stood by our side.
Community worker and former Republican internee Liam Maskey was another person who came under Atlantic's radar when he tried to build links between communities that were sworn enemies.
So obviously North Belfast was being a very divided and an area that was hurting bad in the conflict. I don't have to give you a history about around 92, 93, how things were going and the murders were rising. And for years, for a long time, I'd been just sort of feeling, just trying to find ways to try and get communities working together, just to even if we could reduce conflict at some level. You know, I was running a youth club committee, I was running a boxing club, running a community group. So I'd heard about this guy called Billy Mitchell, who was a former UVF life prisoner who was doing great work in the lower end of North Belfast. And I made a connection through a minister from the Protestant community, and Billy agreed to meet me. I don't know whether I was naive or romantic, but we sort of said, well, why don't we join the two organisations and have the first inter-community baby in North Belfast?
Atlantic was able to step in and lend financial support, but it wasn't only money that was being invested in Northern Ireland. Chuck, in an American delegation, including Neil O'Dowd, founder of the Irish Voice newspaper, were working politically behind the scenes with people and organizations from both sides of the divide.
So there was obviously the Hume Adams talks, there was the government talks, all those things were going on, but we were working away back and forth with loyalist groups. We brought them over to America. We brought guys like Gary McMichael, David Irvine, Billy Hutchinson.
People like Billy Hutchinson, who was skeptical in the extreme as a former loyalist prisoner, that this was just more Irish-American money going into the old Republican cause.
Irish-Americans had to give people like me, unionists, guarantees. You know, it was giving people confidence that they were there and they were not going to go down one side. What they were going to do was to actually work for peace.
However, what Chuck did next threw his impartiality into question.
Yeah, one of the things that Sinn Féin wanted was a guarantee that they could operate freely in America, like many other international groups do, have a Washington office. And it needed about $1 million to fund it. So the only person I knew who had enough money to do it was Chuck. And I always remember when I asked him, you know, can you put up $1 million to start a Sinn Féin office in Washington? He didn't blink. He said, sure. And it's the only time I've ever asked anyone for $1 million. In terms of Northern Ireland, Chuck was completely fearless. He didn't care about criticism.
But criticism is what Chuck faced from many people, including from his close colleague at the University of Limerick, Ed Walsh.
I was not pleased with his decision. At the time, it seemed absolutely wrong to help establish a Washington office for Sinn Féin. And in hindsight, that proved absolutely correct. He brought those who were involved in terrorist activities, he brought them into the political loop.
A number of years later, the peace process was going to be signed.
Today's historic agreement marks a new beginning for all of us in Northern Ireland, on the island of Ireland, and in these islands. It's a day we should treasure, a day when agreement and accommodation have taken the place of difference and division. And today is about the promise of a bright future.
Chuck wound up at Stormont Castle, and while he was in the crowd, Martin McGuinness spotted Chuck, and he rushed over to embrace Chuck and tell the surrounding people that without this man here, this process never would have went forward. And many years later, Chuck gave me a book, The Billionaire Who Wasn't, and Martin McGuinness signed the first page in something to the effect of my good friend, first deputy minister of Ireland, and in parentheses, he wrote, your fault, and he signed it, Martin McGuinness. So Chuck gave me that book, and it's one of my treasured possessions.
And what of the loyalist, unionist fears that it was all a one-sided venture? How does Billy Hutchinson look back on it now?
Irish Americans probably played a bigger role than most people think. You know, there was no doubt about it. We asked for guarantees from Irish America, and we got them. And they supported that. And Chuck was amongst those who were actually involved in that.
Back in the States, things had been unravelling. The secrets were becoming harder and harder to keep. In 1996, Chuck's business partner and duty-free, Robert Miller, took him to court over a business dispute about the sale of the company. And it was this court case which finally blew Chuck's cover as no longer being a stakeholder in duty-free Shoppers. Then there was the small matter of America's biggest shock jock.
And Howard Stern came on in the morning one day and they said, you won't believe this, but there's a guy from New Jersey that's given away all of his money, and this guy's given away $1 billion or $2 billion. What kind of lunatic would do something like that? And that's how we heard about Chuck giving away all his money.
But how did his children react when they first heard the news? Juliet.
I mean, not surprised that my father would have chosen that path. It just seemed like the logical kind of conclusion for who he was.
Chuck believed that it was more fun to give when you were alive than when you were dead.
Martin O'Brien of Atlantic Philanthropies.
Chuck believed that by spending the resources over a limited and concentrated period of time, you could maximise the impact of those resources.
Not only did Chuck decide to give all his wealth away, he made a plan for Atlantic to go broke by 2020 in a pledge of giving while living.
And so he adopted a slightly different approach to philanthropy, which has gone on to inspire other people like Bill Gates and Warren Buffett, who describe Chuck as their sort of spiritual godfather.
Bill Gates.
Yeah, in the 90s, I was studying philanthropists, Carnegie, Rockefeller, thinking about how the wealth that was created by the success of Microsoft should go back to society. So Chuck was a great present-day example of actually doing that. And the style he went about it, the fact that his own personal consumption is so modest, that's really, fantastic. He and Warren Buffett score very well on that. I spent a little more money on my housing and travel than he did. So I often talk about his example. This is the kind of giving that, I wish we could inspire everyone of great wealth to engage in. One thing Chuck did very well, people don't give him enough credit for, is not only did duty-free shopping succeed, but actually the investments that were made out of that corpus, a lot of tech investments, made a lot of money. So the total that Chuck ended up giving away is actually like 3 times larger than his ownership stake in duty-free shopping ended up being worth. And so, he was a very good investor and so able to give, large sums.
And at one time he told me, he said, "Ed, in fact, it's growing faster than I can give it away." So he started off with $3 billion, but he actually gave $8 billion away between 1984 and 2020.
I think Atlantic's achievements in Northern Ireland are huge. I mean, it invested nearly $555 million over the period of its involvement in Northern Ireland.
Author and journalist Susan McKay compiled the official report on what Atlantic Philanthropies achieved in Northern Ireland.
I would say, particularly for me, the investment in buildings and in programs for universities and medical centres were tremendously important. And actually, Chuck Feeney's children have said of him that he was essentially a bricks and mortar man. So investment that was made in, developing Queen's University in Belfast, for example, it moved from being 39th in the UK for research intensity in 2001 to being 8th in the UK in 2015. And a lot of that was down to huge investment by Atlantic. I mean, it did do tremendously good work. But on the other hand, Atlantic never had a strand for funding work with women. It never funded feminist organisations. And I think that kind of highlights the fact that there were never sort of transparent criteria as to how you would get Atlantic funding. He himself seems to have been an eccentric figure, shuttling about the world, supervising this extraordinary distribution of money that he could have spent on himself and his family.
Knowing Chuck Feeney was one of the great privileges of my life.
He is the most remarkable human being I have ever met. And because of his wish to remain anonymous, much of the world doesn't know what he has actually achieved. He believed intensely in the role of education, which had transformed his life. And he focused on attempting to create integrated education in Northern Ireland. He gave some 10 million to stimulate the creation of 29 integrated schools.
There's been people who don't even know they benefited from Chuck Feeney. They wouldn't know who he was. But the reality is there's been plenty of beneficiaries.
What Atlantic and Chuck's money did in Northern Ireland included funding the Sonic Arts Research Centre at Queen's and the Millennium Forum Theatre and Derry, Londonderry, financing Ulidia Integrated College in Carrickfergus, to the Centre for Molecular Biosciences at the University of Ulster. And in recognition of Chuck's work in supporting higher education across the island of Ireland, Chuck received an unprecedented joint honorary doctorate of laws from all 9 universities in the North and the Republic. However, you won't find a plaque on a building or his name in neon lights.
It was a pretty amazing journey, and maybe my small part of being his driver or his wingman or his buddy or whatever it may have been, and my brothers feel the same way. Maybe we were a small part of anything.
I think he was a person who seen the opportunity to be himself, the ordinary guy and the ordinary person and the decent human being in him.
You know, one of the greatest things, I think, is that my dad has been able to still be here alive and see the end of Atlantic. And for me, it's just been a huge example to follow.
He deserves to be celebrated.
I don't know that anybody as an individual could have accomplished or seen more or engaged more than he did. And I think that's a contrast to today. I think he has earned the right to enjoy a baseball game from his San Francisco home, which he does, and I think takes great pleasure in having arrived at this point in his life and having achieved what he's achieved.